This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Immigration, an American Dilemma, was the topic of our luncheon today. We held a panel discussion featuring Sylvia Puente, who's the executive director of the Latino Policy Forum, Jesus Garcia, Cook County Commissioner and former mayoral candidate, Juan Rangel of Mastery Consulting, LLC, former CEO of the UNO Charter School Network, and John Rowe, philanthropist and chairman emeritus of the Exelon Group and a member of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. A very lively discussion was held by the four, and they raised the point that all Latinos are not immigrants and all immigrants are not Latinos. In fact, about 46% of the Latinos in Illinois and 54% of the rest of the population, the 54% would be immigrants from Europe and Asia, only 46% from the Hispanic countries. They agreed that there's about 11 million undocumented immigrants, 8 million in the workforce. Most of the Latino growth in Chicago and Illinois in the last 10 years has been from people living inside the United States. In other words, births over deaths, and only 15% of the growth comes from people who have come to Chicago and Illinois from outside the state. They focused in on the current rhetoric coming out of Washington and the Trump administration, and they felt that this was a harming Chicago and Illinois both in the short run and in the long run, culturally, economically, psychologically, putting an incredible stress on social agencies. Fewer immigrants, they agreed, would not necessarily mean more jobs and higher wages for Native Americans or put less of a strain on social services. All four agreed that the immigrants add more to the economy than they take away from the economy. Question was raised if we faced mass deportation of our immigrant groups. What effect would this have on Chicago? The speakers and questioners agreed this would create chaos in areas of agriculture, construction, leisure, hospitality, manufacturing, retail, and professional services, healthcare facilities such as hospitals. Immigration has kept Chicago's population stable over the last 10 years. In fact, immigrants have set off the native decline in the state of Illinois. Attempts to restrict immigration would compromise Chicago economically, socially, culturally, psychologically, and morally. Finally, they looked at the question of legalization. Legalization must happen. That is the only solution. But currently, the politics are not in concert, so don't expect anything to happen in the area of legalization in the coming future.
Welcome to everybody.
Good afternoon. The Latino Policy Forum, one of our many initiatives is that we run a leadership program that this year is really focused on strengthening leadership between the Latino and African American community. But what we often say in that leadership program, especially when we have non-Latinos participate, that they're Latinos de corazón. So Mr. Rowe, I'm giving you not the gringo at the end, but the honorary title of Latino de corazón, which means Latino from the heart, because of the work that you do. So some of you may have this, but those of you that know the Latino Policy Forum, we always sort of start from the data. And at heart, I'm a data geek and then dabble in this messy world of politics and policy on occasion. So we have this sheet out, I think, at the front. But it basically just gives the demographics of who's an immigrant among the Latino population and who's an immigrant in the state of Illinois. And oftentimes we conflate the two and think that all Latinos are immigrants and all immigrants are Latino. And this is the data that actually tells us that of all of the immigrants in the state of Illinois, about 46% are from Latin America. So that means the majority of immigrants in the state of Illinois are from Europe, Asia, Africa, and other world regions. So it's not totally, totally accurate to think of the two as being one and the same. And then we just sort of unpack that a little bit in terms of how many Latinos are citizens. And one of the things that I like to say is that we're obviously in this very contentious immigration environment that we're dealing with, given our new federal policy. Illinois has always really been a pretty welcoming state for immigrants, but the city of Chicago and to up to our state legislature. And what this tells us is that these days, most of the growth in the Latino population is being driven by people who are born in the United States. Of all the Latino demographic growth that we've seen since 2000, which has been substantial, only 15% is due to immigration. So regardless of how we resolve the issue at hand that we're going to have a conversation on, the Latino community will continue to grow in the state of Illinois. So with that, I'd like to start by just asking my first question to each of the panelists and ask you to respond in kind. We know that the title of this event is Immigration, the American Dilemma. Is immigration a dilemma? And if so, how or why? Chuy, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Thank you so much for the invitation to share a little bit of my personal experience and experience that I've learned, including from many of you in the audience today. To the first question for our panel, and I'm honored to be on the panel with my two co-panelists this morning, individuals who have deep involvement in this topic and in issues related to the topic. My first instinct at hearing that the title of the forum this afternoon was to want to argue that immigration is not a dilemma. In a more ideal world, that it shouldn't be a dilemma. Our country could not be as great as it is if not for immigrants who have come here over many years and contributed immensely to the development of our country and everything that we cherish about the country. Nevertheless, history shows us otherwise. We look back to one of the first politicizations of immigration policy as federal legislation. We come across the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1884 in our history, banning the immigration, the migration of people of Chinese origin to this country. And then we have the Immigration Act of 1924, which stops immigration from Asia and Africa and Latin America, or reduces it dramatically, and gives preference to immigrants from Northern Europe, not too far south. And then in later on in the 20th century, not too much later, we experience the forced repatriations of millions of Mexicans. It is estimated that two-thirds of those who were forcibly repatriated to Mexico, people of Mexican origin, were actually U.S. citizens. So while I want to argue that it should not...
We've been deporting people a long time. Is that what you're saying,
Chuy? Pardon me?
We've been deporting people a long time.
We've been deporting people for a long time, and the debate has been with us. My greatest concern about this dilemma, because I'll acknowledge that it's a huge dilemma, is that the dilemma has been heightened and colored, no pun intended, by the rhetoric that paved the path to the White House of our president, in that the continuing vitriolic rhetoric is harming the country and really jading people against immigrants and immigration at a point in time in our history when the vast majority of the American people viewed immigration and comprehensive immigration reform as something that should happen.
Okay. Juan?
Well, first of all, let me thank the City Club for having me back on this stage after a brief hiatus. And also on a very important issue that's not only for our community, but for our country. Well, the issue is whether immigration is a dilemma. Of course it is. Our nation elected a president who began his campaign demonizing Mexicans as rapists and criminals, and he won. But it's not only a dilemma in terms of the broader country, in terms of what are we going to do moving forward with tens, 10 million, 11 million undocumented individuals, not to mention all the rest that have come beforehand, including my parents back in the 1950s. But it's a dilemma for immigrants who, by and large, don't necessarily come here with the idea of staying. They dream of one day going back. For some reason or another, or sometimes by default, they end up staying. And it's a dilemma for them. It's a dilemma for children of immigrants, American-born children who have challenges of their own identity. Are they Mexican? Are they Hispanic? Are they American? And I think those are very relevant. And I think you see it in the news. I mean, immigration, whether it's more recent arrivals or whether at the turn of the century, the last century, not more recently, the challenges that immigrants bring to a broader society. We see it in our neighborhoods, school overcrowding. Those are very real. You just have to read the newspaper and the gang violence that occurs in our neighborhoods. Those are very real. They don't only affect a broader society, it affects our community as well. Those are our kids that are being gunned down, shot, killed in many instances. To question whether it's a dilemma, absolutely it's a dilemma. And I think it's up to all of us to figure out what we do and how we move forward. I would say I think everybody here on this panel, on this table, pretty much agree on where we want to go in terms of the goal. I think we may differ in terms of the path and how we should get there or how we'd like to get there as well.
Okay. John?
Well, I thought I was going to be the minority here as the House gringo. Since I've been admitted to better status, I guess I'm the minority here because I'm the House Republican, which is probably a more unpopular group in this room. But let me begin with what I think to be the beginning. We're all immigrants, every bloody one of us, just a matter of when. My wife's grandparents were new immigrants from Italy. I haven't seen the invitation from the Sac Indians to my Welsh great-grandparents to come to southwestern Wisconsin, but I'm quite certain there was no such invitation. So we're all immigrants. And I became part of Josh Hoyt, Sam Scott, Becca Shee's IBIC group because of the kids at our charter school. I couldn't figure out why Gene and I were working so hard to educate kids to throw them out of the country. Just made no sense to me then, makes no sense to me now. Beyond that, I don't see why it's conservative to tell people they can't work and pay taxes. I thought we wanted people to work and pay taxes, so that's where I come from. But now, yes, it is a dilemma. Because any time you have 70% of the voters in the primary of one party voting for people who at least for the moment profess to be anti-immigrant, you got a problem. And we got to figure out why that exists. I mean, I grew up in a rural area. The Norwegian and Welsh Protestants were very suspicious of the Irish Catholics. Everybody looked the same. Everyone came from the same quarter of Europe. And yet we had reason to discriminate. So we're dealing with issues of people and change in populations and change in culture. And those inspire fears as well as hopes. And we need to respect those fears and respect those hopes without kowtowing to them. Because we really have no choice but to make this a good place for all of us. There is no other choice in America. There never has been. We can't be Japan. It's not one of our choices. So we need to make it work. And in my IBIC work, we've done as much economic study as we can. We try to stick to the economics because that's what we think we add. We represent big businesses, small businesses, agriculture, hospitals, churches, universities, schools, like universities like Dominican with Donna Carroll's here. And all of those people need immigrants. We need high-skilled immigrants. We need low-skilled immigrants who are willing to work. in the end, it's not a matter of is immigration good for the economy. Simple fact is immigration is necessary for the economy. We have no good choice. But for me, for Gene, like for the other people on this table, the moral issue is even more important. Gene was chatting with a third grade boy, and they were talking about the election. And he said, well, I was born here, so I can stay legally, but my parents can't, and Mrs. Rowe, I don't know how I can live here without my parents. Mm-hmm. There's only one acceptable answer to that, and that is, yes, they're welcome too. There is no other acceptable answer. So that's what we work on here.
And just to follow up a little up on that from any of the panelists, I think, Mr. Rowe, you made a very compelling argument, which is sort of what I always say when I talk about immigration, is that we can say dilemma or not, but it's an essential of our economy, right? Essential to making sure that our salads get picked, our children are taken care of. For every undocumented immigrant that comes across, there is more than likely an employer who is willing to hire them. So I will pick on you being the lone Republican at the table. Why do we have this resistance within the Republican Party to really doing what we need to do to regulate immigration, even if it's just to meet our economic needs?
Because large portions of old-fashioned America are afraid. They see their world changing, and it's changing in ways that are faster and larger than they want it to change. And they have to come to terms with that. It's the job of people like me to help them to come to terms with it. But for what it's worth, I respect the people I grew up with in rural Wisconsin every bit as much as I respect the people on Michigan Avenue or down in Hyde Park. People are people, and if you don't start by believing that, you're going to have a problem on immigration and a whole lot of other things.
So thank you for that.
Sylvia, if I can add to that.
Sure.
Just a brief story. When we were trying to open up, when we opened up our school on 47th and Kildare in the Archer Heights community, we're familiar with Archer Heights. That was a traditional Polish community. And in the last 10 years, 15 years, it's undergone a tremendous change, and it's become a Mexican community. And when we tried to open up a school there, we had resistance from some of the neighbors that had been there for a very long time. And this included some of the churches, some of the priests, some of the Polish priests that would tell me that ever since those people came to our neighborhood, our community has changed. And their complaints were about, and very basic things, graffiti in their garage, the gangbanging, the lack of parking, just the overcrowding, too many kids, it's dirty and all that. And I think it's hard to hear that, but I think for us on the other side of this issue, and to go along with what John said, I think we have to be respectful of those changes as it affects other people. I don't believe, as much as their rhetoric sounded harsh about those people, talking about my community, I don't believe that they were racist. I think they had deep concerns about their community, and the challenge to us is to alleviate those concerns, that this is actually a good community. We have our challenges, but it's actually a very good, very productive, hardworking, very entrepreneurial community, but I think that falls on us to try to alleviate those fears on other folks.
And Juan, I think we can call it racist or not, but it's sort of like what's intent and what's outcome? The outcome is that they may not be racist, or people may not be racist in their hearts, but to Mr. Rowe's point, there's a lot of fear, right? Mm-hmm. And the end result still is the same, that those fears creating blockages, it's creating tension, it's creating discrimination, it's creating lashing out where people are feeling not safe, right? So, you know, I guess one question I would have for all of you then is to what degree is it our responsibility to try to pacify that fear as a Latino community, right? Where, of course, we want to be courteous, but at some point we've got to recognize this is the new demography of America, right? Whether we like it or not.
Well, we have a responsibility to, as leaders, to be honest and to be straightforward. And when we see racism, it's important to call it for what it is. You know, I've been privy to, because I'm light-skinned, I'm on the lighter side of the Mexican identity, to hear conversations that people have, especially on the southwest side of Chicago, having attended a Catholic high school, St. Rita High School, to all the Mustangs in the room. All-boys school, unfortunately. It's why I went to UIC. I wanted to experience the co-ed life, and I did, and it's been great. But even at a setting where you have the Augustinian priest teaching some of the best values on the globe, there was racism, there was hatred, there was intolerance, there was all the language that comes with it. So while we want to create safe spaces for honest conversations where people can overcome their prejudice and their racism, we also have the responsibility to speak truth to power. And just like we cannot get away from the legacy of our country and the policies we've instituted against Native Americans, first of all, and then the struggle of people of African ancestry, our African American sisters and brothers from our history, so it is that we must be honest about immigration and everything that it sets off. And there are good, you know, there's good reason, good logic why people should feel apprehensive about continuing arrival, of people from different parts of the world to this country. And it's because certain groups have been stigmatized, certain groups have suffered from structural and institutional racism. And it's better if we acknowledge that the conditions for having breakthroughs and reducing, minimizing the amount of pushback against why immigration is good for the country can reach better levels of understanding when we do that.
So I've told 5 minutes and I've only gotten through one out of my questions. So I'm going to jump around a little bit, gentlemen, from the questions that I had given you. But let me talk about education, because I know that you all have been strong advocates in education. There's a recent Pew Research Center study that reported that education was the top issue of importance for registered voters. I know that each of you has been very involved in education issues. And as you think about the intersection of immigration and education, what is your educational philosophy with respect to how to foster education pathways for economic mobility for Latinos and other immigrants, especially for those children who are undocumented? What are the key components of your educational philosophy? How does this compare to promoting bilingual education versus English immersion, cultural acculturation or assimilation?
Anyone?
Well, for one, as an immigrant and the first in my family to be able to attend college, and thank God for the University of Illinois public university system that enabled me to do that, I know firsthand the importance of education in order to enable people to experience success and to achieve the American dream, to go on and be successful in every aspect of life. As a professional, as an entrepreneur, as a civic leader, as a corporate leader, because we're beginning to see more and more of those fruits come to fruition. But education is critical, and the struggle for equity and to ensure that everyone gets access to it is very fundamental. Because again, if we look at who has had difficulty in society accessing and excelling in education, it again has been Native Americans and African Americans. Thus, the importance of our ability to fight for educational access and inclusion. It's the key to people succeeding, whether it is someone who immigrated here and was a low-wage worker, being able to get training, go on and get a high school diploma or an equivalent, go on to city colleges. That is key. But it is important that as we do that, we be mindful of children and what kind of experiences they have. You're asking us about our philosophy. I have been a longtime advocate of bilingual education, of acculturation in our society, because if we are to stay a global leader in the hemisphere and across the world, the more languages that we know, the better off that we are in that regard. I say acculturation and not assimilation because oftentimes, as we examine the history of the Mexican-American people, assimilation has been used to deny people an identity, to seek to get them to forget their culture and their history and their language. And I think that need not be necessary. We can stay and keep an identity and a culture while we learn the ways of other people around us in our society, whether it's the Jewish community in the U.S., the Irish community, the Polish community. So you don't have to give something up to become acculturated and to become a larger part of our society.
So I guess this is where I would disagree with what you just said. And it, more in terms of the meanings of those words of bilingual education and assimilation or acculturation for that matter. I'm a strong proponent of having able to speak multiple languages. I think that we showed that in our schools, the 16 schools across the city, that I had a higher percentage of English language learners, higher percentage of poverty kids, and a higher percentage of minority children. Yet we immersed our children in English. From day one, we didn't have bilingual teachers teaching them. And guess what? Our children actually learned English very quickly. I don't know that bilingual education was intended to maintain or retain your culture. And not that that's a bad thing. I'm a proponent of that as well, but that's not what bilingual education is. Bilingual education should really be is really the process by which you transition children into English. And for the life of me, I don't know why it takes 6-7 years in the public school system when we would actually do it in several months. In all that time, in the 15 years that I ran schools, thousands of children that we educated, 98% of them Hispanic, majority of them of Mexican descent, not one complaint from our parents. Our parents actually want our kids to learn English. Do they want them to retain their language? Of course they do. That's why we provide them with Spanish teachers. We provide them with a Spanish class because guess what? A lot of our kids do know, have a good foundation in Spanish, but no one's teaching them how to speak it properly or write it properly. Why don't we do that as a school? But not at the expense of English. Our parents understand that if they're going to succeed in this country, they need to know English. Why don't we do that for
and
our kids?
We'll save this debate for the next conversation, but why is that mutually exclusive? When all the research really points to bilingualism being an asset.
It's not. It's not mutually exclusive. The problem that we have, we don't have enough quality, qualified bilingual teachers for the number of kids that we have. That's just the fact across the country. So what do we do in the meantime? Just relegate them to subpar teachers? No, there are great teachers out there. They just may not speak Spanish, but they do. Our kids will learn English. On the question of assimilation, I would just disagree. You don't have to give up your native culture, language, and tradition to assimilate. But at some point, we have to accept that we are Americans. We have to make sure that we challenge our community as they become investors in the success of this country. It doesn't help us if they're in limbo, a little bit over there, a little bit over here. No, they're here. They are investing in the success of their children, the success of their community. Why not push them a little bit further so they can also invest in the success of our nation, their nation as well? It doesn't help us to keep them as a separate group from the broader society.
And again, I don't think that it's an either or, Juan. I think we can have this. We could certainly have this conversation again. But, John, do you have anything to add to that?
A few. Fortunately, you don't have to hear most of them. First, Gene and I sponsor a parochial school that is in a Latino neighborhood that once was Polish. And we've actually heard firsthand a couple examples very much like those I've heard here. But the kids are nearly all Latino, and they want to learn. The cultural difference isn't anywhere near as big a part of things as simply the basic problems of teaching and financing and working with kids. We have a charter elementary school in a mostly Latino, partially African-American neighborhood. Again, the kids want to learn. Their parents want to learn. Elementary school parents are very active. It makes a huge difference. We have a high school in a mostly African-American, partly Latino neighborhood. Different set of cultural issues, different set of conflicts. But they all need good teachers. They all need people around them who care, particularly the kids from broken families. It is endlessly both heartwarming and astonishing how much seniors in high school are just looking for love from somebody and how often you have to show up to give it to them. They're fairly suspicious. They don't count it right away. And I don't think this is a philosophical problem. It's about inculcating personal responsibility from a very early age. It's about helping kids with necessary resources. It's about being for them. Gene and I give $250,000 of scholarships every year at our high school to college. The larger part goes to undocumented Latinos. Why? Because by and large, our African-American kids get the scholarships they need. It's the undocumented Latinos who don't have resource to the public funds. I mean, Frank Clark and I used to think energy could be hard. Energy's not really very hard. It's only politics that makes it hard. But education is a real bear. It's one kid at a time. It's one teacher at a time. It's one family at a time. It's hard work. And while it's a little different Latino to black, and it's a little different white to Latino, and it's different yet Asian to white, the real needs of the kids are just hard, and giving them what they need and giving them the right mix of accountability and love is just a very difficult challenge.
Great. So lots of questions here, and I'm going to give them all a test now. Can you answer in one sentence?
Run
that's
sentence.
What we're
he's in the bar.
So lots of questions from different folks. Heloise, who wants to know, where's Heloise? Who wants to know, how can we be effective in helping families who might be broken up by deportation, which we know is happening every day? What concrete tips can we do to assist? And related to that, Judy Thornburg is asking, where's Judy? In the back, how can we protect a person's assets if they're deported without notice? And Mary Meg McCarthy, where's Mary Meg? Who essentially wants to know, what do we do as a community to fight notary fraud? Because so many people who are addressing these issues have been taken advantage of by people. So what do we do around fraud to protect people's assets? And what do we do when people are deported without notice? And you may not have all the answers, but where will you send people to? What's a good resource for them?
One sentence? Are you? They're very multifaceted.
Okay. Two sentences.
Okay. One, I think we need to continue to drive the point that the people mostly affected by what's emanating from Washington are children and families. That's critical. Two, there are outstanding organizations across the city of Chicago, the National Immigrant Justice Center, Just One, Resurrection Project, and Pilsen, but they're all over the city of Chicago, and they're all stepping up their game to be able to provide more assistance to prevent fraud, et cetera, in the area of immigration.
Great. Anything else to add? Yes.
go see my friend Becca Shee at IBIC first, go see Raul Raimundo at the Resurrection Project second, and help us all pass a comprehensive immigration bill third.
All right. Thank you for being succinct. So related to that, and when we talk about the need for immigration policy, it can be so complicated. So Carlos Ponce, where's Carlos? Carlos is asking the question, what should immigration policy be? Do we have a controlled border or an open border? So given that immigration policy is so complicated, what is one thing that you think is necessary to have in federal immigration reform?
Comprehensive immigration reform would do a lot to minimize all of the hype around a wall.
All right.
That's a very complicated question. I think it depends on whether we actually want to see an immigration reform or we just want to talk about it as well. A real immigration reform is going to have to include a give and take, a negotiation, and not, we're not going to get everything.
Well, what one thing do you think is most important to have in immigration reform?
Why? Well, the legalization, first of all, but you're not going to have 11, just being practical. Just being very practical in political reality, you're not going to have 11 million people legalized. It's just not going to happen because the politics aren't there.
So a dilemma, legalization, but it's not going to happen.
No, that's not what I said.
I'm making fun of the title.
let me finish the answer here. Legalization has to happen. There's 11 million approximately of undocumented immigrants. Somewhere along the line, we're going to have to cut the cord and say, okay, we'll be satisfied with 8 million, 9 million if we want it to pass. If we say 11 million or nothing, well, then 11 million people get screwed, right? We have to be able to negotiate some level of enforcement at the border. That's just reality. Do I like that? No. My parents came here as undocumented immigrants, too. But in terms of practical reality, do we want to see something passed? You're going to have to negotiate with the other side. And I'll tell you, I don't think every Republican is a racist. All right? We got to get that out.
Well, we know, we
and
certainly...
And I don't think anyone has said that.
No, but our rhetoric sometimes implies that, and I think that we need to get away from that. We need to have a practical agenda of how do we get something passed, especially in this climate.
So Mr. Rowe, what's the most important thing for you in that practical immigration agenda to have happen?
This is a run-on sentence, so I apologize. part of it has to be our own rhetoric. And I think if we claim, which I believe, that immigrants are good for this country, these are hardworking individuals, they're entrepreneurial, they're family-oriented, they have all the right ingredients for American success, let's bolster that. But at the same time, our rhetoric includes, well, we have to somehow coddle them because we need special programs, special needs, and all that. That doesn't fly with the other side. And at some point, we have to realize we don't have the votes on our end. We have to bring over some of the other folks. And I'll tell you, Trump voters, a good number of them voted for Obama twice. So I don't think that they're racist. They have other issues that they need to want to address. I think it's our job to figure out who they are and how do we bring them over to our side. But it falls on us.
Okay. And what's the most critical ingredient for immigration reform for you, Mr. Rowe?
Well, just as a beginning, for those of you who are into the great political divides, the original sin of the right is always ethnic and cultural discrimination, and the original sin of the left is always class discrimination. That's the great dividing line in politics, if you like those analyses. But what I think we need is a very sharp, clear definition of what is the kind of felony that makes someone an immigrant we don't want. And the state police here in Illinois has 8 factors, of which 7 are pretty good. The 8th one is the problem. But so we need a definition of what makes someone unacceptable. And my guess is that out of the 11 million, 10.8 are probably totally acceptable under any decent definition. But we need to legalize as many of the 11 million as we can, as fast as we can, and let them work legally and live decent lives free of harassment. That's step one.
All right. And so maybe to end on something.
Can I just finish? Step two is we need a different family-friendly immigration policy that allows both high-skilled people and low-skilled people to come into the country to take jobs that need to be filled. That's a much more complicated issue than my first step. But it can be done, and it must be done, because we're going to keep having the undocumented problem until we get such a policy. And I believe we will get there. I'm frustrated, angry, sick, whatever word you want, that it's so long and so slow and so hard, because justice delayed is justice denied. And yet, we will get there because we must.
One more? No. All right, I was going to say maybe we could end on something that we all agree on, which is why is the Latino community so important to the Chicago area economy? Let's just suffice it. I think we've heard from all of our panelists that it is.
Thank you. Let's give everybody a round of applause. John Rowe, Juan Rangel, Chuy Garcia. By the way, Chuy, your wife Evelyn sent me a message saying it's a good thing you went to UIC. Three kids, three grandchildren. You wouldn't have gotten that at St. Rita. Okay. And what a wonderful job Sylvia did. Thank you very much.